From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Yes, the main reason, in our view, that this forced evacuation expulsion is a serious mistake is that it sends a message that this is rewarding terrorism. By rewarding terrorism, you will only encourage more terrorism, not only in Israel, but God forbid around the world.
As Israeli troops begin the forced evacuation of thousands of Jewish settlers in the Gaza Strip, we host a debate between the Zionist Organization of America and a Palestinian professor of Middle Eastern studies. And as the Israeli army plans to demolish settlers' homes after the evacuation, we look back at the bulldozing of a home in Gaza that killed American activist Rachel Corrie.
I mean, Rachel had to take that stand. She couldn't have moved out of the way. She knew her friends were behind that wall.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli troops have begun the forced evacuation of thousands of Jewish settlers in the Gaza Strip after a deadline for them to leave expired midnight Tuesday. Unarmed Israeli soldiers broke through burning barricades and marched door to door, ordering people out of their home in five settlements. Scuffles broke out as protesters burned garbage, fought with police officers, and threw eggs and water bottles at them. Settlers in some farming communities were seen burning their greenhouses and homes rather than leave them to the Palestinians. Police said one woman was arrested for stabbing and lightly wounding a soldier. Soon after the incident, Sharon beseeched settlers not to attack soldiers, saying, quote, "Don't blame them. Don't make it hard on them. Don't hurt them. Hurt me." We'll have more on the Gaza withdrawal in a few minutes. In Iraq, at least 43 people died this morning when three car bombs exploded during rush hour in Baghdad. Officials said another 76 people were wounded. Two of the bombs targeted one of the city's main bus stations. A third bomb exploded outside a nearby hospital. Meanwhile, the Independent newspaper of London is reporting the 1,100 dead Iraqi civilians were counted last month at the Baghdad morgue. That's the highest toll in recent history. In Crawford, Texas, Cindy Sheehan has announced her 11-day-old anti-war vigil will move locations in order to get closer to President Bush's vacation ranch. A local Crawford resident has offered her to set up Camp Casey on his property. Sheehan has vowed to remain in Crawford until the president meets with her. Last year, Sheehan's oldest son, Casey, died in Iraq. He was 24 years old. The right-wing attack on Sheehan is intensifying. Last week, Fox News host Bill O'Reilly described Sheehan's actions as treasonous. On Monday night, a Texas man drove his pickup truck through the vigil site, running over hundreds of white wooden crosses and American flags that had been put up to honor soldiers killed in Iraq. The man, Larry Northern, was arrested and charged with criminal mischief. Sheehan vowed there would be no retaliation.
We're all here for peace, and we're not going to lower ourselves down to the level of the violence, and we're not going to let them get us off our mission either. This isn't only about my son. This is about all of the over 1,800 people who have been killed in this mistake of a war. This is about the 130,000 who are still over there for no reason. This is about the millions of Iraqis in harm's way for no reason. We want this to end.
Meanwhile, support for the anti-war protest in Crawford is growing. Tonight, Move On is helping to organize more than 1,000 candlelight vigils around the United States to support Cindy Sheehan. In Britain, the TV network ITV has obtained leaked information that indicates the British government may have lied about key details involving the police shooting of an innocent Brazilian electrician aboard a subway car in London. According to the leaked witness statements, the man, Jean-Charles de Menezes, was being restrained by a member of Scotland Yard's surveillance team at the time he was shot. In addition, the leaked information indicates Menezes was wearing a thin denim jacket, not a bulky jacket, as police said. It also now appears Menezes never ran from the police. He only began to run when he saw his train pull into the station. Menezes was shot by police shortly after the July 21st attempted bombings in London. A Pentagon analyst and two prominent pro-Israeli lobbyists have pled not guilty to charges of conspiring to obtain and disclose classified national defense information. The Pentagon analyst, Larry Franklin, is accused of leaking highly classified information to Stephen Rosen and Keith Weissman, both of whom worked at the time for AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. The information reportedly dealt in part with U.S. policy toward Iran, Iraq, and the war on terror. According to the indictment, AIPAC was under an FBI investigation for over 5 years, beginning in 1999. The indictment also indicates a group of other officials inside the Pentagon, as well as other foreign officials, and an unnamed Washington think tank also played a role in the alleged spy ring. This news on the September 11th investigation. A veteran Army intelligence officer has told the New York Times a secret military intelligence team repeatedly contacted the FBI in 2000 to warn about the existence of an American-based al-Qaeda cell that included four of the would-be hijackers, including Mohammed Atta. The officer, Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaeffer, said military lawyers blocked the team, known as Able Danger, from sharing any of its information with the Bureau. Schaeffer is the first military official to discuss this information publicly. Last week, the heads of the September 11th Commission announced that it knew about the Able Danger team, but it concluded it, quote, did not turn out to be historically significant. According to the commissioners, the only claim that the military had identified Atta as a threat prior to the attacks came from a single Navy officer. In Haiti, the jailed Catholic priest Gerard Jean-Just has reportedly almost died after collapsing in his cell Sunday. Jean-Just's attorney, Bill Quigley, reported this after visiting Jean-Just Tuesday. Jean-Just is one of Haiti's most prominent supporters of ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He's been in jail since July 21st, but has not yet been charged with a crime. In India, police have arrested 43 people during a protest march outside a Coca-Cola factory. Organizers reported four activists were hospitalized with severe head injuries after police charged the demonstrators with batons. Coke has faced widespread protests throughout India. This is Amit Shrivastava of the India Resource Center.
Basically, the issues are that Coca-Cola is extracting too much groundwater from the groundwater resource, and it's leaving the communities without any water all across India. And the pressure on the Coca-Cola company continues to grow in India, and it's become one of the most formidable campaigns, community-led campaigns against the corporation in the world today.
The Coke protest Monday came on India's 58th anniversary of independence from British rule. The Justice Department has taken the unusual step of asking a federal court to remove a judge involved in a 9-year-old class action lawsuit filed by Native Americans seeking billions of dollars in unpaid and gas royalties dating back to the 19th century. Last year, the judge, Royce Lamberth, held Interior Secretary Gail Norton in contempt of court. He's also been highly critical of the Interior Department for failing to identify how much money Native America tribes owe. Lamberth recently described the Interior Department as, quote, the morally and culturally oblivious hand-me-down of a disgracefully racist and imperialist government that should have been buried a century ago, the last pathetic outpost of the indifference and Anglocentrism we thought we'd left behind. Lamberth has consistently ruled in favor of the 500,000 Native Americans covered in the class action suit. Last month, Lamberth said in a ruling, quote, our government still treats Native American Indians as if they were somehow less than deserving of the respect that should be afforded to everyone in a society where all people are supposed to be equal. In Venezuela, investigators are trying to determine the cause of Tuesday's plane crash that killed 160 people. It was the deadliest plane accident in the country's history. In Mississippi, the state's attorney general has asked that Ku Klux Klansman Edgar Ray Killen be put back in jail. Killen was released on bail on Friday. 6 weeks ago, Killen was convicted of masterminding the 1964 killings of three civil rights workers. The state attorney general also revealed that one of Killen's brothers threatened to kill the judge in the case a week before the trial began. And Coretta Scott King has suffered a stroke. The 78-year-old widow of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. has been hospitalized and is reported to be in fair condition.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israeli troops began the forced evacuation of thousands of Jewish settlers from the Gaza Strip today after a deadline for them to leave expired last night. Unarmed Israeli soldiers broke through burning barricades and marched door to door, ordering people out of their homes in five settlements. The operation is the culmination of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's disengagement plan from the Gaza Strip, which has been occupied by Israel for nearly four decades. Troops and police grabbed settlers and pushed them into buses. Scuffles broke out with a large crowd as protesters burned garbage, fought with police officers, threw eggs and water bottles at them. One woman set herself on fire during an anti-pullout protest in the Negev town of Netivot. She was seriously wounded. Settlers in some farming communities were seen burning their greenhouses and homes rather than leave them to the Palestinians. One man took a sledgehammer to the walls of his home. Police said Wednesday morning in the last 24 hours they'd arrested 498 people, of whom 451 were released. Police said one woman was arrested for stabbing and lightly wounding a soldier. Soon after the incident, Sharon beseeched settlers not to attack soldiers, saying, quote, "Don't blame them. Don't make it hard on them. Don't hurt them. Hurt me." Further confrontation looms as hundreds of Israeli troops escorted by bulldozers marched into the Nevi Dikalim settlement, a focus of resistance where thousands have defied orders to leave. IDF officials are reportedly hammering out a deal with settlement leaders whereby the settlers would leave by this afternoon. Government eviction notices went into effect Monday, but settlers were given 48 hours to leave or be removed from all 21 settlements in Gaza and four of 120 in the West Bank. Many of Gaza's 8,500 settlers packed up trucks ahead of today's deadline to quit Gaza. But the army estimated about half the settler population would remain in defiance. Officials say two-thirds of settler families have accepted compensation deals. Those who refuse to go could lose a third of the money, ranging from $150,000 to $400,000 per family. According to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, a senior aide to Sharon said all or nearly all of the 21 Gaza Strip settlements could be evacuated within 48 hours, declaring the opposition to the disengagement has failed. The army intends to pull out the last troops from Gaza in early October and turn over the land to the Palestinian Authority. We go now to Gaza to speak with reporter Chris McGreal, a correspondent with the London Guardian. He joins us on the line from the settlement of Neve Dikalim. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Chris.
Good afternoon.
Can you talk about what's happening there right now?
Well, in Neve Dikalim, things have moved relatively slowly, partly because there's been quite a large number of young infiltrators, ultra-nationalist kids who come from, many of them from the West Bank or from within Israel proper, rather than from the Gaza settlements. They came in to try and disrupt the whole process and are responsible for the burning barricades and the attempt to puncture tires of the security force vehicles and just generally setting up blockades that you've been talking about. That meant that last night some of the settlers who wanted to leave weren't able to do so. So much of this morning has been spent with those settlers willing to go without force being used are now being put onto buses and their furniture being moved into removal vans and then driven out. As you say, there is negotiation going on between the settlement leadership here and the Israeli security forces. We'll see how that works out. The Israeli army is taking the attitude that they want everybody out of the settlement by 7 p.m., which is within 4 hours. And I have to say that the way things are progressing, it's hard to see how that's going to happen. But there are many, many hundreds of police and Israeli soldiers in the settlement right now. And if they were to move in, I think then there would be quite a large number of people who would resist. We're waiting to see what actually happens.
Chris, can you describe who some of the people are who are resisting?
Well, there's two kinds, really, and there's a division between the two groups. The first group is as I mentioned to you, these young ultra-nationalists, what are known as hilltop youth from the West Bank, who generally believe they're not governed by the rule of law. They answer to a higher power, and they've come here to try and disrupt through any means possible, with the exception of violence, they say. disrupt the withdrawal so as to protect what they say is rightfully part of the land of Israel. The other protesters are people who actually live in the settlement, have lived in the settlement for many years. These are families. They're not necessarily very happy about the tactics of the youth. They want to make as a point of principle, they do not want to voluntarily get on the buses. They say they will have to be carried from their homes. They'll have to be lifted onto the buses against their will. But they don't intend, on the whole, to take to the streets and try and use sabotage. Many of those people have already shipped their furniture out in a realistic expectation that their days were numbered, but they simply weren't prepared to walk out of the settlement voluntarily.
We're talking to Chris McGreal in a Gaza Strip settlement. You talk about settlers coming from the West Bank. What will happen to them?
Well, it's not immediately clear. Their legal position is that they are in breach of the law and they could face arrest. They, right now, those that are caught are being put on buses and taken away by the police. Whether they will face charges or not, I suspect will depend on whether the government feels that it's politically worth their while to pursue this. I think it will also depend on whether, once all this is over, these young people, who are mostly in their teens, many of them girls, actually, whether they have caused sufficient disruption or whether there has been significant violence as to whether it's bothered to charge them. So far, there's only been really two assaults on the police. There was a very nasty incident yesterday when one of the settler youth threw ammonia into the eyes of a policeman. But that was the most serious incident we've had. And I suspect if it doesn't go very much beyond that, the government will simply decide it's not worth turning these young people into martyrs within the settler movement.
We're talking to Chris McGreal of The Guardian. He is in the Gaza Strip. Yesterday we talked to Amira Haas, the Israeli reporter from Haaretz. She said that there is, of course, a good deal of focus right now on 8,000 settlers, but what is not being talked as much about is the fact that there are 400,000 settlers who will remain in the West Bank.
Well, indeed, and in fact, one of the great debates about Ariel Sharon's true intent here is whether pulling out of Gaza, removing a relatively small number, as you say, of 8,000, is really a means of protecting the 400,000 who live in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. It's interesting that there are twin messages that come out from the government and from Sharon. There's a message to the outside world, which is firmly this is not the case. When Sharon's Deputy Prime Minister Ehud Olmert held a press conference last week with the foreign press, he said categorically there is no attempt to use this to consolidate our position in the West Bank. Simply untrue. There's no Israeli government policy of that kind. Interestingly, Ariel Sharon told the Israeli press today that getting out of Gaza protected the Israeli settlements, Jewish settlement blocks in the West Bank, a twin message depending on the audience. And I think that ultimately, because of the way that this has been unilaterally implemented, the way that the government's made it clear that it is not in the short term interested in negotiations with the Palestinians, and above all because of the construction of the barrier through the West Bank and Jerusalem, I think many people here will conclude that the Gaza pullout is not unconnected with the fate of the Jewish settlements in the West Bank.
This is Democracy Now! As we wrap up with Chris McGreal from Gush Katif settlement in the Gaza Strip. What do you expect will happen now?
Well, I think one of the things that's most interesting about this is that for all of the dramatic pictures that have been played out, particularly to the Israeli public, showing settlers weeping in the arms of weeping policemen and weeping soldiers, and the attempt to project this as a huge national trauma and as enormously difficult and coincidentally, probably not able to be carried out in the West Bank, is it the fact that it had actually been rather rather untraumatic in a national sense. I mean, obviously, for people leaving their homes after 20 years, whatever the reason they were here, it's very difficult. But at the same time, most are going. I mean, going without some great protest or physical protest. And I think that that won't go unnoticed by the rest of the Israeli public when the time comes to try and negotiate the fate of the West Bank. But there's a general feeling that under the present government of Mr. Sharon, it's unlikely that those negotiations are going to move forward, and it will probably take another government before the benefits of pulling out of Gaza are actually realized.
Chris McGreal, I want to thank you very much for being with us. He's in Gush Katif in the Gaza Strip. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 350 stations, radio and TV around the country. I'm Amy Goodman. In our next segment, we'll have a debate between a Palestinian professor, director of Middle East Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the head of the Zionist Organization of America. But right now, as we continue to look at developments in Israel and Palestine, we'll go back 2 weeks ago. The Presbyterian Church warned four U.S. companies to stop providing military equipment and technology to Israel for use in the occupation of the Palestinian territories, or else face a vote by the church to divest its stock in them. A church investment committee accused Motorola, Caterpillar, ITT, and United Technologies of selling helicopters, cell phones, night vision equipment, as well as other items used by Israel in its occupation of Palestinian territory. Other mainline Protestant churches have followed in the campaign of the Presbyterian Church, using corporate divestment as a tactic in the Middle East conflict. The Episcopal Church of USA, the United Church of Christ, two regions of the United Methodist Church, as well as international groups like the World Council of Churches and the Anglican Consultative Council, have all urged similar economic boycotts of Israel. One of the companies that's facing divestment is Caterpillar. Last week, President Bush visited the company's manufacturing plant in Montgomery, Illinois, where he signed the Federal Transportation Equity Act. For years, Caterpillar has been a target of activists because of its sale of bulldozers to Israel that have been used to demolish Palestinian homes. This campaign gained momentum after the death of Rachel Corrie, the young American woman who was crushed to death March 16, 2003, by an Israeli military bulldozer as she tried to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home. In March 2005, the family initiated lawsuits against the State of Israel, the Israeli Defense Forces, and Caterpillar, the family of Rachel Corrie. Subsequently, they've been joined by Palestinian plaintiffs in the suit against Caterpillar. This summer, members of the Palestinian family who lived in the home Rachel was defending came to the U.S. to travel with her parents, Cindy and Craig Corrie, on a national speaking tour. We caught up with the Corries and the Nasrallah family, Khaled and Sama, during their national speaking tour earlier this summer. I began by asking Cindy Corrie about the significance of the tour.
When Rachel sent emails to us from Rafah in Gaza, one of the things that she said was that it was important to bring Palestinian voices directly to the people of the United States rather than having their voices filtered through the voices of well-meaning internationals such as herself. And for Craig and for me, it's almost a miracle that we've been able to bring part of the Nasrallah family here and to see them talking directly to Americans. But we definitely feel like we're continuing Rachel's work in trying to get the word out and to bring this story to people here.
Khaled Nasrallah, can you talk about the Rachel Corrie you knew before she died? And in fact, did you see her die on that March day?
Sure. Rachel Corrie has been reflecting the new generation of youth in the United States. She came to see on the land what is happening and judge by herself and to try to help to end this conflict, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, by peaceful ways. She lived with us around 3 weeks. By this daily knowing her, we see how she was very human, how is she was friendly, how she was good, and she used to play with our children, watch the cartoon television with them, help our wife in the kitchen. She was a very, very nice and good girl. About what we saw in her death, I may let my wife tell you about.
Sama Nasrallah.
لو تقدر تحكي لنا إيه اللي شفتيه لما توفت؟
أنا وقتها وقت ما توفت كنت أنا في الجنينة. كان وقتها سلفي ندح علينا إنه الدبابة عم بتقرب على البيت.
At that time, my Khaled brother called us to come to the garden as the tank and bulldozer have been coming to our home.
وقتها احنا كلنا نزلنا في الجنينة كانت ريتشل واقفة خلف السور بتاعنا كانت لابسة سترة أورانج جاكيت أورانج وكانت معها ميكروفون عم بتقول الدبابة وقف كانت الدبابة عم بتقرب على البيت.
At that time, Rachel has been stand in between our home and the tank, which has been around 200 meter far and open land, and she was holding a mega phone, talking wear an orange vest. She was talking to the tank driver, telling him, "Stop! There is children inside the home."
وقتها ما تخيلت انه يصير هيك حادث كانت الجرافة عم بتقرب عليها زاحت كومة الرمل واجت فوقيها ورجعت الجرافة تاني للأسف كان جسمها أبسط وأنحف من يكون جرافة مثل هيك تيجي فوق جسمها
يعني. At that time the driver of the bulldozer didn't stop and to continue moving toward her. We didn't imagine that any human being can continue by this way. He push the sand on her and squeeze her by his fork.
وقتها أنا
I didn't never expect that happened or she can survive from this fatal injuries.
وقتها طلعت أنا فوق بيتي أجيب لها ضمادات للجروح ما تخيلت إنه ممكن يكون إصابتها خطيرة وقتها طلع سيلفي يشوفها شالوا عنها شوية الرمل بس للأسف قال حالتها خطيرة ترجم
At that time I ran to our my home to bring the first aid to help Rachel. I think it is not injured and I didn't never try to think she will die. So I bring the first aid to my brother, wife, husband, brother, Dr. Samir, and he go to help her, but it was very bad injury for her.
يمكن أنا شفتها ومشيلينها الحمالة كانت كتير حالتها صعبة ما تتخيل شو كان شكلها كان كتير صعب ما تخيلت إنه ممكن يكون في إنسان ممكن يعمل هيك يموت إنسان بهيك طريقة.
Last time I saw Rachel when the ambulance came and I saw her in the stretcher lying with her blood. This moment for very hard to me and I never forget her.
Yeah.
Sama Nasrallah describing what happened on that day through her husband Khaled Nasrallah on March 16th when Cindy Khoury's daughter Rachel Khoury was killed in Gaza in Rafah. Cindy Khoury, how do you listen to this description now on this speaking tour over and over again? Have you learned anything new about your daughter's last moments?
I've heard this story in so many ways from so many people. Sometimes on the speaking tour, we actually don't go into the details of it all because sometimes it is hard to hear it over and over again. I think I didn't know about Sama, though, watching and then going to get the first aid kit. So and her feeling that somehow Rachel was going to survive. That's all new information to me. And I think too, even in our family, I didn't have the sense, the understanding that now I do about the fact that, you know, all of the children, the Nasrallah children, were behind that wall. They had come downstairs when the bulldozers appeared, the ones who were upstairs, because they didn't know what was going to happen. And so Rachel knew those children were behind the wall, five young children at the time. There are now six children, but there were five at the time. And of course, the adults as well. I think maybe that's the point that has been made even more clear to me, that of course, I mean, Rachel had to take that stand. She couldn't have moved out of the way. She knew her friends were behind that wall.
And so what are you doing now, Cindy Khoury? You have filed lawsuits against the company that made the bulldozer Caterpillar against the Israeli government. What is your campaign at this point?
Well, we're doing a number of different things. We're still working with the U.S. government to try to get a U.S. investigation. My husband Craig, my daughter Sarah, and other members of our family continue to make trips to Washington, D.C. We are now, we have a contact in the Justice Department. We understand that they are still considering the possibility of a U.S. investigation. For a long time, we had been led to believe that that wasn't possible, but it is being considered at this time, and we're still calling for that. We know the U.S. State Department is now on record saying that the report of the investigation does not reflect an investigation of the Israeli military investigation does not reflect an investigation that was thorough, credible, and transparent, as was promised to President Bush by Prime Minister Sharon that it would be the day after Rachel was killed. We have a letter from the Chief of Staff to Colin Powell that states that the investigation was not adequate, and also that was reinforced in testimony by Ambassador Kozak before a subcommittee of the House International Relations Committee this spring. So we feel that there's still real reason, and it's not only our family but others that believe that more needs to be done. We have filed the suit against Caterpillar Corporation. I think it's really important for people to know that Palestinian plaintiffs have been added to that lawsuit. People families have joined it who had family members that died in Jenin and also in Gaza when Caterpillar equipment was involved in the demolition of homes. And we have also a civil suit in Israel. And, of course, the legal process moves very slowly, so there hasn't been a lot of progress at this point, but both of those are underway. On this tour, of course, this is another dimension of the work that we're doing. We're working with the Rebuilding Alliance we brought this family here. We've been traveling since June 8th. We started on the West Coast in California, went to Oregon, to Washington, and then to the Midwest, Michigan, Wisconsin, and we're concluding in Iowa, which is Craig's and my home. We grew up here in Iowa. And it's been really heartening to me to see people come out all along the way to hear directly from the Nasrallah family. I think this story is still very important to people. It was 90 to 100 degrees in Des Moines and in Iowa City this week. Last night we were in the Islamic Center here. There was standing room only. There were fans trying to cool everybody off, and people stayed through 2 hours to hear this story. So I feel very good about getting this word out. We're also trying to raise funds to rebuild, first of all, the Nasrallah home, and then another and another, to have a presence in Gaza, a grassroots American presence that says to people that we know what has happened. We know that 1/10 of the population of Rafah have lost their homes during the past 4.5 years, and that we know we have a responsibility in that as Americans, because we funded the equipment that has done that work. We funded the Israeli military, and that is disengagement is being discussed, and as we're waiting to see how that unfolds, that we continue to stand with the people of Gaza to support them until there is truly a viable existence for the people of Gaza.
Cindy Corey, they're joining us in Des Moines with the Nasrallahs, whose home Rachel Corey was standing in front of, defending against a Caterpillar bulldozer operated by the Israeli military. On March 16th, 2003, 3 days actually before the U.S. invasion began in Iraq. Khaled, can you talk about what happened to your home? Was it demolished on that day after Rachel was killed?
Actually, when the bulldozer have been coming to demolish our home and Rachel by her soft body stopped the bulldozer at that time, we struggled to continue living in our home in spite of this heavy pressure from the Israeli army about our home to force us to leave. But because the value of what is Rachel done to us, we continue living in our home for another 7 months because we believe Rachel spent her life, and we believe we are innocent and didn't anything against anybody, and we only hope in the life to save our home. So we continue living, but they make a very intensive invasion in our neighborhood. They around our home from all sides and start to make digging around three sides of our home. The depth has been from 5 to 7 meters under the establishment or basic construction of our home. And they hold us 3 days in our home while it was moving on us. You can imagine how it's bad when you feel your home may demolish on you and your wife and your children. Anytime. But because we are Palestinian, if we go outside the home, the tank will shoot us. So the two choices, staying in the home or going out, is very dangerous for us. In this campaign, they cut the water supply, the electricity supply, they demolished the sewerage, they cut the telephone line, they destroy many of the wall in, of our home, the windows, the doors. So at this moment, we can't continue living in this home. Plus that they demolish the road which have been going to the home and make it like hell to avoid anybody to move or walk in this street. So it was very bad day for us as we became homeless and refugees at that time. After another months, they came in another campaign and complete demolishing the home, and now it's became underground.
Khalid Nasrallah and his wife Samah, along with Cindy Corey, mother of Rachel Corey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We were speaking with them in Des Moines, Iowa. They were on a national speaking tour. Rachel Corey died on March 16, 2003. When we come back, a debate on the Gaza pullout. We'll be joined by the director of Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and the head of the Zionist Organization of America. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Again, the latest news out of Gaza. Israeli troops have begun the forced evacuation of thousands of Jewish settlers. This comes after a deadline for them to leave expired last night. This operation is the culmination of Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's disengagement plan from the Gaza Strip. Israeli security forces say in the last 24 hours they arrested 498 people. More than 450 have been released. Government eviction notices went into effect Monday, but settlers were given 48 hours to leave or be removed from all the 21 settlements in Gaza and 4 out of 120 in the West Bank. Many of Gaza's 8,500 settlers packed up trucks ahead of the Wednesday deadline to quit Gaza. But the army estimated about half the settler population will remain in defiance of the order. We're joined in our studio now by Rabab Abdulhadi, a Palestinian professor who is director of Middle East of Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. We're also joined in the studio by Morton Klein, president of the Zionist Organization of America. It's based in New York. He lives in Philadelphia. Well, Morton Klein, let's begin with you. Your reaction to the pullout today?
Well, besides this being a human rights disaster, suppose Ariel Sharon were to remove there are 10,000 Arabs who live in Tel Aviv among a million Jews. If he had decided to remove those 10,000 Arabs, I think the world would be responding quite severely against this. But remarkably, of course, the 10,000 Arabs there don't need protection. They don't have to worry about their lives being harmed, as the Jews, of course, are always under threat by living near Arabs. But my biggest worry about this is that this clearly rewards terrorism. And as an American and who's a supporter of the international war against radical Islamic terrorism, I am afraid that if you're rewarding terrorism in Gaza and Israel, Al-Qaeda, Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terrorists see that if terrorism works there, it'll only encourage more terrorism against us, against the West, against Europe. So this is my biggest fear, why I'm against this policy.
Professor Abdulhadi.
I'm stunned by some of the mainstream media coverage and the way in which many supporters of the Israeli government's policies, including Mr. Klein here, the way that it's being portrayed, and that if 10,000 Arabs or Palestinians were displaced. In 1948, close to 900,000, almost a million Palestinians were displaced. Ariel Sharon was the leader in Lebanon in 1982, and he had a hand complicitly and was found complicit by the Israeli government to have contributed to the massacre of Palestinians and Lebanese and other people in Sabra and Shatila. There have been a lot of displacements of Palestinians. I'm actually, I would like us to have some kind of a view of history, to sort of have a historical perspective and remember what are the various steps that have happened in terms of displacing Palestinians. One. The second point I'd like to make is this is the settlers, the Jewish settlers who are there illegally in contradiction of all international laws and all every single law, okay, and they are supposed to, they're not supposed to be there in the first place. They should not have been there. The settlements should not have been planted. They should not have been able to live and thrive while the where they're living on stolen Palestinian land, sucking out the water, which is very much needed, from Palestinians and making lives. And I think this is a serious issue. I think this is the way we need to look at it, is that little 1% maybe of the wrong, historical wrong that has been done to Palestinians is being corrected. Only 1%.
Martin Klein.
I must respond to that. First of all, in 1948, when Israel was reestablished on about 12% of original Palestine, that was to be split into an Arab state and a Jewish state, six Arab armies invaded Israel in 1948. That is why several hundred thousand Arabs left their homes because of that invasion to the new sovereign state of Israel. If they hadn't invaded that new state of Israel to destroy that state and murder the Jews who lived there, there would be no refugees, no Arabs would have left. And to say it's against international law is absolute nonsense. Please, let's try to stick to the truth here. Gaza was controlled by Egypt in 1948. Egypt captured this area. They controlled it from 48 to 67. This was Egyptian land that they held illegally, not recognized by the United Nations. So this was disputed land, not anyone's sovereign land. So when Israel went and captured in 67, in the defensive war where Egypt, Jordan, and Syria attacked Israel, it was perfectly legal for them, under the United Nations rules, for them to build homes in that area.
Morton Klein, you've met with Ariel Sharon many times. Why do you think he's doing this?
I asked him this question when I met with him at the Blair House, across the street from the White House, in early May. He told me what a tragedy this is, and he said he's had enormous pressure from Europe and the United States to make some sort of major move, or else there was all sorts of threats of various consequences. That is what he said to me, with 30 others in the room, as to why he's doing this. Because to this unilateral withdrawal, to get nothing in return, only sends a message that terrorism pays. This is a historic mistake. Giving it over to Mahmoud Abbas, the head of the Palestinian Authority, who has already invited Al-Qaeda to come into Gaza, Hamas to set up headquarters there, and other terror groups from Syria are all announced they're going to set up terror groups there to establish a terror state.
Professor Abdelhadi.
Yeah, well, I just want to give some corrections in terms of the literature that's available out there, including Israeli literature. I would point out at least two books written by Israelis, Zionists who were founders of the Israeli state, Simcha Flapan, who wrote a book about the myths of the creation of Israel, talking about that the whole question about Arab armies invading Israel in 1948. This was one of the myths. There is five other myths, and I would just refer your listeners and your viewers to those books. There is Avi Schleim, there is Benny Morris, who later on had a different change of heart ideologically, but never changed the facts that the Israeli archives, which were declassified, have pointed out. And Mahmoud Abbas, by the way, did not invite Al-Qaeda into Gaza. Anyway, no one knows who Al-Qaeda is or where Al-Qaeda is, because if anyone knew this, the United States, which is claiming to be waging a war on Al-Qaeda and groups like it, would have found them a long time ago. So this is, I think if we want to have a debate, let's talk about the question of facts and truth and so on. I think it's a serious problem to actually say that the Palestinian Authority, which is actually exercising maximum reserve, I don't even even know how they are doing it. They're asking the Palestinians not to go and celebrate too much now, so the Israeli military is able to remove the settlers. They are asking them not to resist the occupation. They're asking them not to do anything at this point. Mm-hmm. I'm actually surprised by the behavior of the Palestinian Authority. If anything, the Israeli government and the Israeli people should be thankful to the Palestinian Authority, which is making the removal of the settlers with the huge compensation that they are getting, millions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of dollars compensation for something that they never even paid for.
I want to ask Morton Klein a question.
Correct one thing, if I may.
Yes.
Mahmoud Abbas went to Damascus, Syria, 1 month ago. He invited all the terror groups there, the Palestinian terror groups, to move into Gaza as soon as Israel leaves. Al-Qaeda announced on Tuesday they're going to come into that area. And also, this occupation, this is not even accurate. Rabin gave away 85% of Gaza in 1994, where the million Arabs live in Gaza, and for their own autonomy and control. He gave away almost half of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, over between 94 and 96, where virtually 98% of the Palestinian Arabs live under their own autonomy and control.
I'll let you respond to that in a minute, but I just want to ask Morton Klein a question about compensation. The Israeli settlers will get between $150,000 and $400,000 a piece, something like that. And the reports in various papers, like the New York Times and others, that the Israeli government will be would like the U.S. Congress to pass, what, another $2 billion to bail out the Israeli government on this removal. Is that right?
I've seen stories about it. Nothing has been formally introduced or requested at this point.
You're also on the executive committee of AIPAC.
Yes,
right?
I am.
Are you pushing for that, for the the additional $2 billion?
Well, I can only speak for my organization, ZOA, and frankly, we've taken no position on it. We have many other things that we're dealing with, so we have not taken a position on that issue. What we're doing on the Hill regularly is pleading with the United States to stop the doubling of money to Mahmoud Abbas until he fulfills even something of the roadmap. He hasn't dismantled or disarmed Hamas. He hasn't ended the promotion of hatred and murder of Jews in TV, radio, newspapers, speeches, and sermons, and Americans, too, I might add, promotion of hatred against Americans. He continues to smuggle weapons, Sharon told me this himself, from the Sinai into Gaza to bring into the West Bank for a new terror war in the West Bank, and he doesn't arrest terrorists. So until he does that, we are lobbying that there should be no money to be given to Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority.
Professor Abdul Hadi.
Yeah, first of all, when Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, went to Damascus, he went to meet with the representative of the PLO group, the Palestine Liberation Organization, which continues to be the sole legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. And he is meeting with them in order to produce national unity among the Palestinians and come up with a policy of how to lead this nation. I do not necessarily always agree with everything the Palestinian Authority says, but in that sense, actually, to be able to provide some kind of a peaceful way of negotiating Palestinian differences and have a government that is representative of the various political views among the population, I think it's a great and laudable step. That's number one. So it wasn't representatives of terror groups. You can say that. And Al-Qaeda wasn't part of that. There are negotiations, just to be factual, there are negotiations between the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and Islamic Jihad, on the other hand, who have until now not joined the Palestinian Authority or the PLO. There are negotiations because they are part of the Palestinian people, and they do have popularity among Palestinians, as the municipal elections in Gaza have proven. May I just say one more thing about, unless you want to move to something else, well, about the whole question of U.S. aid to the Israeli government. Mm-hmm. Is that okay? I think it's really a problem to say that the United States government is giving huge amounts of money to the Palestinians. Among the money that the United States actually Congress authorized for the Palestinians were money, I think about $50 million or so set aside. I'm not good on figures. I'm a qualitative researcher. But they set aside to actually improve the checkpoints, to build more fortification on the checkpoints that prevents Palestinians from going from one village to another, from one city to another, in search of hospitals, jobs, education, and so on. to allow the Israelis. This is the money is taken away from what is allocated for the Palestinians to give to the Israeli government to build fortifications on the checkpoint.
I mean, the professor is saying how
popular Hamas is. They've won 60% of the vote in many elections in Gaza. It really tells you something about that society. Hamas's charter not only calls for the destruction of Israel, the destruction of all of Israel, not simply to the 67 border. It calls for the murder of every Jew, including me and my family, including every Jew in New York. And it calls every Jew a Nazi. And this is an organization that's popular among the Palestinian Arabs. This is an organization that Abbas asked to come into his government. Can you make peace with a Jewish country when you're inviting in a group that calls for the murder of every Jew and destruction of the country? This is the nonsense of Mahmoud Abbas. But we should remember, Mahmoud Abbas wrote a PhD thesis in Moscow saying the Holocaust never occurred. Wrote a book in 1984, said the Holocaust was a lie by the Jews in order to create a Jewish state. And by the way, in terms of aid, we've given over $1 billion in aid to the Palestinian Arabs since the Palestinian Authority was created, over $1 billion. And the reason there are checkpoints is because Arabs keep killing Jews. If Arabs didn't come into Israel and murder Jews, there wouldn't be a single checkpoint. They don't have checkpoints because they enjoy having them.
Professor Abdelhadi.
Yeah, I think it's very unfortunate to have this inflammatory speech, because when you do things of this sort, it makes it impossible to have any kind of discussion, intellectual or otherwise, to reach any kind of peaceful solution. First of all, I think to say that society, Palestinian society, to label a whole society, is not only stereotypical, but it's racist. Number two, to say that Palestinians are likening Israel to Nazis. I have been reading nothing in every single account of newspapers until now. Young Jewish settlers who came from the West Bank to support the settlers in Gaza have been calling the Israeli army Nazis. And I think it's very interesting, because in this sense, nobody is calling these young Jewish settlers anti-Semitic. But when Palestinians and others who are saying what Israel is doing in the occupied territories, in some instances, looks like what Nazi Germany did. Nobody is saying it's exactly the same. Israel has not exterminated 6 million Palestinians as the Nazis exterminated 6 million Jews, along with 20 million other people from other nationalities who seem to fade away. But I think we need to sort of like look at a contrast and compare the whole picture and look at what's going on here. I think it's really the Palestinians are sticking to the roadmap. If you want to talk about the roadmap, removing the settlers is part of the roadmap.
A single element of the roadmap. Have they dismantled or disarmed any terrorist group?
I would appreciate not being
interrupted. Have they stopped the incitement or arrested terrorists? Please don't say they fulfilled the roadmap. Name one thing they've done to fulfill it.
Removing the settlers and actually freezing the settlements on the West Bank, which is the whole question of growth is continuing on the West Bank. Support of that is part of the roadmap. Well, if you want to talk about what...
Professor Abdelhadi, we have to wrap up. I'm sorry we give you the last word because we gave Morton Klein the first. Morton Klein of Zionist Organization of America, Professor Abdelhadi, Palestinian professor of sociology, heads the Department of Arab American Studies at University of Michigan, Dearborn. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkadoush, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Skay, Hill, Nell Geiser, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami. Our website is democracynow.org. Special thanks to Uri Galed. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.